This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Dylan worked on Empire Burlesque for most of 1984. He began writing the songs in rehearsals early in the year, around the time he was jamming with the Plugs, which of course culminated in that March appearance on Late Night with David Letterman. When his first live shows of 84 began, the first concerts he'd given in 2.5 years, he brought songs to work on during the tour. That tour went through Italy, Germany, Switzerland, France, Spain, and England between May and July of 84. And when it was over, Dylan headed to New York and began to record. At this point, Dylan is producing himself. Musicians were coming and going. He worked in 2 different studios in New York in July and booked more studio time in LA in November and December of 84. As 85 began, he was in the studio as well, with more sessions in LA in January, and early February he went back to New York and was there through early March. Arthur Baker was there for those last New York sessions and had another session with Dylan where he did a ton of overdubs. Baker would later get a remix credit on the record. This batch of sessions, 9 different groups of dates over 9 months, produced Empire Burlesque. It was released on June 10th, 1985, 18 months after Infidels. When the world first heard Empire Burlesque, reviews were mixed, but mostly positive, if not effusive. Rolling Stone said it put the snarl back in Dylan's music. The Milwaukee Sentinel said it sounded half-finished. And Robert Christgau called it his best album since Blood on the Tracks, but said, "I wish that was a bigger compliment." Today, I'm going to talk with Jim Baviglia about Empire Burlesque. Jim is an author and journalist who writes for American Songwriter and Culture Sonar and many other music websites. And he's written a bunch of books, including Counting Down Bob Dylan's 100 Finest Songs, Playing Back the 80s, and others. There are links to Jim's writing and books in the show notes. I got in touch with Jim after reading his Empire Burlesque commentary on a website called Countdown Kid, a site where he ranks each song on an album. And he's done a ton of Dylan albums, Costello, Petty, Zevon, and other similar artists. He joined me to talk through each of the songs on Empire Burlesque. We stick mostly to the released album, but later this season we'll do an episode on both the Springtime in New York outtakes, there are 12 tracks there, and all the other unreleased stuff from the sessions mentioned earlier, because a ton of them circulate. Now, here's our discussion of Empire Burlesque with Jim Baviglia. All right, Jim Baviglia, welcome, and thanks for coming to talk about Empire Burlesque.
Well, thanks for having me, Craig.
Yeah, so the reason I reached out to you was an older review I found that you wrote, not contemporaneously, but back when you were looking at a lot of albums, and you write a lot of reviews about, there's a lot of Dylan albums on this site, which I'll put the link into. You've got your 100 Best Dylan Songs book, as well as I see on Amazon that series now covers at least half a dozen artists, which is pretty cool. But anyway, today we're going to look at Empire Burlesque, which marks the beginning of what I'm calling the 5 worst years of Dylan, at least in terms of releases. An interesting album. There's a lot to say about it and a lot that went into it. So we'll talk about it. But I guess, tell me, how did you come to Empire Burlesque, meaning where in your journey, Dylan journey, was that? And what was your initial reaction before you decided to go back and look at it 10 years ago?
Yeah, I'm a child of the 80s, so I vaguely remember, some of the videos from the 80s. But it really wasn't until I got into Dylan heavily when I was in college in the 90s and just started going back through all the albums and was a avid review reader like yourself, you know, reading Rolling Stone and all this stuff, and always saw the reviews for Empire Burlesque and saw that, you know, some of them weren't all that kind, and was curious, and eventually, you know, thought back then it was the CD. And when I listened to it the first time, I immediately gravitated to it. You know, I didn't hear, you know, I heard the production concerns that a lot of people had, but maybe it's because I grew up in the 80s and I was used to that music. That didn't really bother me. And I just found it a really accessible album. And, you know, I don't think I would call it one of my top 10 Dylan albums, but I think it might be one of the top 10 that I listen to the most, just because it's, you know, it's never dull. It's, you know, it's like I said, it's very accessible, and you know, it's always surprising. You know, each track has a little bit going for it. Now at the vinyl, and I listen to that all the time. And you know, I've had the chance to write it. I had the chance to defend it many times because, like you said, a lot of people are a little bit leery of this period in Dylan's career. So yeah, I've been kind of on its side from the very first time that I heard it.
I'm in the same boat. I heard it when it was new, but that was Infidels and Empire Burlesque were the first two Dylan albums I had and listened to in college myself endlessly. So I also don't share the negative connotation. I didn't do the 60s and 70s live, so this wasn't, you know, compared to anything for me. And even still, I must say, even preparing for this, I mean, I do listen to this album a lot, I will say, but I listen to it quite a lot. And now there's, you know, there's high-res lossless, so you can actually hear a good version, obviously, of the vinyl as well. And we have the benefit of all the outtakes, which, you know, maybe we'll talk about a little bit. But I spent you know, a lot of time reading up on it and the different versions and takes. But I love this album. I mean, I really do. I think, yeah, is it going to be a top five Dylan album given the other albums? No. But it isn't in the 80s doldrums. You know, it gets worse in the 80s, as we know, for Dylan. So anyway, I'm glad you have a positive outlook on it. The other thing I noticed was, you mentioned the reviews, that the contemporaneous reviews are not nearly as bad generally as the retrospective reviews. Mm. They certainly aren't uniform. You know, Rolling Stone, as you know, Kurt Loder wrote and really loved it. Generally, you know, puts the snarl back in Bob Dylan's music, a blast of rock and roll funneled through dense rolling production. And interestingly, for the first time, the music rivals the words for pure pugnacity. And there's some others of that time. Obviously, some people, you know, didn't feel that way, but, you know, we're here a little bit to praise, not bury. So anyway, what you did on this website called Countdown Kid, which is pretty interesting, is you rank each song, I guess, 1 to 5 stars. We don't have any ones in this on this record. And so, you know, I thought, just as a way to frame the conversation around it, we would just go through the album in album order and talk a little bit about, you know, the songs and your reactions.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. And it is interesting you mentioned those reviews, because it seems like, you know, all the 80s stuff in retrospect gets hard. And that's for every artist. You know what I mean? Like, when they would come out in the 80s, everybody was kind of on board with them. And then everybody kind of looked at the 80s, well, oh, the production. And I have a hard time looking at it that way. And that goes for all those albums. And I think it's important to look at it in that context, too, because Dylan was looking at, you know, hey, David Bowie did this album where, you know, with the contemporary sounds, had some big hits. Bruce Springsteen the year before had Born in the USA with, you know, the synthesizers on the first track, which was, you know, anathema for Springsteen, turns into a big hit. Don Henley, all these people, these contemporaries were going this route. And so I think Dylan, you know, was kind of just falling into line with everybody. But I do think he gets judged at a higher standard because of what he had done before. And I think that skews the way people look at this album.
Oh, I agree. I think it skews it entirely. You know, as you listen closely, even to the production and the, you know, the playing, you know, there's a famous quote, semi-famous, but, you know, from Keltner, that, you know, he was taken off a song and put on, replaced with a drum machine. And now we have Keltner's version on the Springtime right. box. But if you just listen to it, you know, I feel like if you're not, I don't know. And clearly this is very personal. Like we said, kind of when you came to it, it's all great sounding music. And I think to compare it to other albums of other folks, either at the time or later, I think it stands up. We get into the words, you know, Michael Gray, I reread last night his chapter on Empire Burlesque, and he's pretty hard on it from a, you know, holding it up to, you know, he does one side by side comparison of Spanish Harlem you know, and there's one set of metaphors that he finds to, you know, and yeah, what's going to hold up next to Spanish Harlem? You know, I'll remember you. It's not. But anyway, well, let's take a look. So the first song on the album, which is at the time and to this day, I completely love, and we have three versions in a video, is Tight Connection to My Heart, at least as it was titled this time. And you gave it 4 out of 5 stars in your retro review. So I want to tell us what you think about that then, now, and maybe now that we have all the outtakes.
Yeah, it's interesting that this is definitely the song where you feel like he was reaching for that hit. You know what I mean? It's got the great hook. It's got the backing singers. I mean, it's just that it was always a tough bit for Dylan to be heard in that way, because the lyrics were never going to be as easy to digest on the radio as a Springsteen or, you know, any of those other people I mentioned. It's just that's not the way he writes. So I think in that respect, I mean, he was probably overreaching trying to get a hit. But in terms of just hearing the song now on its own, it's this fascinating thing. It definitely kind of sets the tone on the record for this character that he plays throughout. You know, a lot of people have made, you know, note of the fact that he borrowed a lot of lines from kind of film noir movies for this record. And he comes right off the bat, you know, with a lot of these lines. And it kind of sets the tone for the album, sets the character that he's playing. This guy kind of looking out at this world that he doesn't quite understand, doesn't quite relate to. And he's trying to find something to orient himself to this world. And most of these songs, he's looking for that girl or looking for that love to kind of trying to be the thing that settles him in this like alien area that he finds himself. And so I think in that respect, it's a great kickoff album. And again, like you mentioned, like the rest of this record, it sounds great today, and it sounds better today than it probably did upon coming out, you know, now that they have all the remasters and everything. But it's just one of these fascinating songs where Dylan is trying to be a hit maker, and he's ends up creating something totally unique when he tries to do that.
Yeah, well, it is hard, I think, for everyone, naturally, to go back to the time and place. Some people weren't there, but, you know, we're not swirling in that environment. So you listing all those other songs is a good point. And someone else I know you've wrote about, Elvis Costello, you know, he did Every Day I Write the Book. Right. It was kind of, you know, his seemingly reach for a hit in that time. And there's other songs that I think are the same.
And he regretted it afterward.
Well, yeah, he always comes around. But
Elvis, I always think of Elvis because Goodbye Cruel World was another one where he tried to do that. And then years later, when he did the CD reissue, he wrote the liner notes and he said, "Welcome to my worst album." So very, very candid Elvis was about that era in particular.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, his quote of the period was that the 80s was the decade music forgot.
Yeah.
So he tried to write off the whole thing. But Tight Connection is a song, you know, as a Dylan fan, it's one that you think, how can people not love this? Mm-hmm. You know, you can hear it being a hit. You can hear it being, you know, accessible. And even if you're not a words person, it just sounds good. And yet, a lot of these songs stick with the fans and don't cross over. I don't think they pushed this as a single. I don't know if the record company did what they, you know,
right,
could have done with it.
Right.
But it's still a Dylan song, which is cool. It's not, you know, it's not like Every Day I Write the Book. In that case, for example, Elvis, you know, compared to other Elvis songs, it's much simpler and more straightforward. This has the complexity, both lyrical and musical, and inconsistency, meaning it, you know, covers a lot of ground on different parts of the song. And then there's that great video, obviously.
Unforgettable.
The purple wig rolling down the steps. So 4 stars. So it's not at the top of your list, but it's not at the bottom.
Yeah. And 4 stars I consider to be, you know, you put it on a playlist, you know, any playlist you might come up with, it's, you know, it's a song you're going to replay often. So that's, you know, that I consider high praise.
Okay. And the next song on the record is Seeing the Real You at Last, which does not fare as well in your list. Yeah. It's a 2-star song.
Yeah, and I think I might fight with myself on that a little bit now. You know, it is, you know, you listen to these things as time goes by and they kind of hit you in a different way. I don't feel as harsh towards it now. If I have a problem with it, it's that it's a bit more one-sided than a lot of Dylan songs, you know, where a lot of song, you know, the classic one is Idiot Wind, where he's kind of putting you, you know, against this person or against this thing the whole song. And then he comes back around and he says, we're idiots, you know, like that's kind of the Dylan that I'm used to, where he kind of looks at it from all perspectives. This one, it's kind of, well, you know, everything is kind of against this person. It's all kind of anti. And, you know, I've read, you know, people say, well, maybe he's talking about Christianity, you know, that he's had a different kind of thought on it now that time has passed. Whatever the case may be, that's the one issue I have with it. But on those terms, if you could remove it from, well, okay, Dylan doesn't usually write like this, I think it's effective. So I think that maybe I was as guilty as anybody else there of saying, well, you know, I'm comparing it to the other stuff he writes. But if you just compare it to the average, you know, kind of hit maker of that era or the contemporary rock star, I think it holds up a little better in that respect.
Sometimes I think that songs and other things should be graded more like diving in the Olympics, that we need a degree of difficulty score and an execution quality score.
Yes.
And, yeah. You know, the degree of difficulty, this is not shooting to be Idiot Wind or, you know, right. Something else. It's kind of a low grade attempt. And I would agree it's in the bottom third of even of this album. But, and this is the, you know, impossible task we're putting ourselves here to, is that it doesn't make it unenjoyable.
Yes.
It doesn't make it, if it was on the radio in the midst of, you know, 30 other things, it ain't on the bottom of that list.
No.
There's less going on here, clearly, but, you know, it's certainly far from one I would ever skip on play.
Yeah, and I'm glad you made that point, because that's, you know, when I was doing these reviews, that's exactly how I would try to look at it, is, okay, what was the artist setting out to do? And then how well did they achieve that? And you're absolutely right that he's not trying to blow anybody's minds with this song. He's just kind of focusing on one emotion, one kind of attitude, and just kind of sticking with that, kind of driving it home all the way throughout the song. And I think the music kind of accentuates that as well. It's kind of confrontational in its way. So yeah, I totally agree in that respect that he wasn't shooting for big game, so to speak, here. And for what he was trying to do, yeah, it sounds great.
The way the recording process worked is also worth, you know, mentioning a little, which is, you know, he just was recording songs for kind of 16, 18 months in different studios and different times. He was searching about with different players and then deciding as he went which ones to keep, which ones to discard. And I didn't know until I read, you know, getting ready for this, that Arthur Baker was brought in so late in the process. You know, he was kind of handed a bunch of tapes and, you know, and Dylan worked with him, but produced these, so to speak. And he brought in other people that added stuff. Dylan came back and did overdubs. But the point is that in some cases, as we now know, Dylan's editing wasn't great, both in terms of song versions or songs. But in other words, this is a song that probably he wrote, he wanted to finish, he finished, and for whatever reason, it fit the flow of the album, or he liked it more than, you know, obviously there's great songs that came out later from this time period. I don't know. I just think it kind of does matter. I don't think it makes it a worse album. I don't know that we need to care that the guy conceived of the whole thing at once and had a singular intent. But, you know, you can see this as being a song that Dylan thought, okay, I'm going to play around and finish and do, and it is what it is.
I think it's almost analogous to, you know, it's not quite the same, but it's like the Beatles with Let It Be, you know, where they couldn't quite be bothered at that point because they were, you know, they were all kind of infighting and dealing with the lawyers and everything. They just kind of handed it off. And, you know, then after the fact, Paul McCartney was upset about a lot of it. But ultimately, you know, it might be Arthur Baker. And I've seen people, you know, kind of be harsh on Arthur Baker throughout the years and reviews and things like that. But I mean, ultimately, it's on the artists. They're the ones that their name is on it. They're the ones who put this out. I mean, if Dylan could easily have heard what Arthur Baker did and said, "No, this is terrible," you know, and I'm not doing any of this. But he signed off on it. And again, Arthur Baker was just doing what the era kind of prescribed. And so yeah, I think you're definitely right that there's a lot of that to a lot of these songs where you wonder how much Baker's vision might have transformed what was originally there. But, you know, what he ultimately produced was very era appropriate and really still holds up pretty well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to blame him for doing A, what he does,
mm-hmm.
And B, to if you listen to it and you're not against this kind of thing, they're not, you know, they're not shoddily produced. It's not, you know, the vocals aren't buried. They're super interesting. And I actually found, and again, this is an album I've definitely listened to thousands of times, you know, listened to the high res off Tidal last night with a good DAC. And there's just beautiful orchestration of all these things going on. And as I said, the interesting thing we can do now is there's just like songs like When the Night Comes, Song from the Sky, which we'll get to, which we've got two or three other versions now. And Trust Yourself, which is the one that Keltner got bumped off of. And you can go back and hear the pre-Arthur Baker versions months before, none of that same stuff. And you can understand why Dylan didn't want to put them out in that way, because then they're kind of just another guitar and singer song. And as you say, and that both in terms of the time and in terms of doing something different, Dylan doesn't have a vision. He's not driving for something, which in a lot of times in his career he was, but he's looking around. You know, then production certainly should be part of the experimentation. Anyway, I agree that I don't see why Arthur Baker is a bad guy in this. Mm-hmm. You know, he's still doing what he does, yep. And he does it super well. And this album, even listening to those alt versions, the studio originals, I'm very glad that the Empire Burlesque versions exist. And I would never, you know, relegate them and build a version out of the old takes only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gave the album an identity. I think that's what you can really say is, you know, he gave it a kind of a unification of sound. And, you know, some people just don't like that sound, and that's fine. But, you know, I do think, you know, he was, like you said, he was doing what he did with other albums, whether that fit with Dylan. I mean, that's for some people to argue. But I certainly think, you know, like I said, I think it still sounds great.
So next we have I'll Remember You. I think this is really one that starts getting in. It sometimes gets cut for the same reason Make You Feel My Love does. It's, you know, it's too simple, too heartfelt, too, you know, schmaltzy was the word that got bandied about with Make You Feel My Love a lot. But it's, you know, it's sincere, or it seems sincere, and it's Dylan put himself into it and did it. You rate it 5 stars, one of the two best on the album.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad I was actually preparing for this. That was the same comparison I was thinking of making, is to Make You Feel My Love. And there are just some people, again, it to me, it's not fair to hold Dylan to a different standard than other songwriters, as even though he might have surpassed those standards throughout his career, he's right here just writing an adult contemporary song. That's basically what he's doing. And if you think that's easy, I mean, think of all the adult contemporary songs that are very popular that you never want to hear again, that just get on your last nerve. And I think he just does a fantastic job with I'll Remember You. You know, the words are simple, but they're kind of put together in a way that they get to the emotion. I love the bridge in particular. It kind of, Dylan gives us one of those moments. I don't know that this ever happened, that he was ever out somewhere with the wind blowing in their hair. But man, it sounds great, doesn't it? You know, like it sounds like this big moment. And I think that's what he's getting at in this song, is that the people that mean the most to you, they've delivered these moments to you in their life. And then there's a little bit of sorrow in it, because you get the sense that this relationship is over. And he's kind of looking back at it and he's saying, well, you know, we're probably at the end here, but it's meant so much to me, and it's going to keep meaning so much to me as I go forward through life. I don't know if there will be other relationships that do mean this much to me, which is kind of the sadness inherent in the song as well. So I just think it's a great recording. I love Dylan's piano playing. That's just something that always, always, always gets me on these songs. He's just got kind of an idiosyncratic way of playing the piano. Like he'll hit two chords, double them up instead of one when you least expect it. Little things like that to catch me. He's got Mike Campbell adding very subtle but very nice guitar touches on this song. So yeah, this is one I know a lot of people, they hear it, oh, schmaltzy, this, that. And it, for me, I think there's a place in the world for songs like this if they're done well. And again, this is what he's trying to achieve here. And I think he just knocked it out of the park. I just love this song. I've seen Dylan play live 3 times. He played it once live when I saw him, and I was just over the moon that he did. And so I'm always in this song's corner. And that was the case when I wrote this 10 years ago, and it'll still be the case many years down the line.
Your description made me think that it's a corollary to Mama, You've Been on My Mind. 20 or 30 years later.
Yeah.
But I also think your original point is good, and it applies to those other songs. You know, there's Neil Young famously
at Bobfest said, anyone can be complicated, Bomb can be simple.
Yeah.
But it's not simplistic. And some of these approaches about cutting to the core quicker than anyone I knew, so little time to fail. His power of observation, his power of seeing things in a slightly different manner is still there. Anyway, yeah, I think it's a great song. I'm glad you like it so much. We'll get to the other 5-star song in a little bit. Next, we have Clean Cut Kid. Bob's Vietnam song, as people like to point out. Definitely one, I think, where Bob, you know, had an idea, decided to go for it. Tons of funny, inventive, you know, lyrics. Again, it's not Idiot Wind, but I'm very glad he did it.
Yeah, you know,
four stars, I should say. 4 stars for you. So most people would probably put that near the bottom, but you gave it some credit.
Yeah, you know, another song that I just think sounds great right off the bat. You know, that's the thing that, you know, we write about music. It's just, it's hard to express that, but this song to me just sounds great. You know, the little bridges, you know, kind of break up the verses, and Anton Figg from David Letterman family, he's playing the heck out of those snare drums. You know, he's just going to town. And Ronnie Wood, I think, on guitar in this song, if I'm correct. You know, another one of these examples of Dylan just pulling everybody into the studio. So on that level, I love it. You know, I think it sounds great. And I just love that it's kind of a Vietnam song. You know, I think the standard to which everybody holds those songs up to is Sam Stone by John Prine. And it's not that, because it kind of weaves away from that a little bit as you get towards the end. Well, why is this Vietnam vet in Hollywood with Peter O'Toole? You know, like how does that jibe with the first part of the song? I love that it kind of veers out of control in that way. You know, one of the things that I love about Dylan is kind of the idiosyncrasy, where he's just doing things that don't quite make sense, but they make the song more endlessly entertaining and you know, where you can go back to it over and over again. And so, yeah, Clean Cut Kid for me is that, you know, it's just kind of unexpected. And like you said, fun. Again, if you had said to somebody, okay, Bob Dylan's going to write a song about a Vietnam vet who's having a hard time adjusting, you might think it was somber or, you know, very maudlin. And instead, like you said, it's funny. There are lines in there that just crack you up. Again, I make these mixes, and this is one that I'm always throwing on there because it kind of fits with everything. And yeah, I have a blast listening to it. I don't know if that's the intended effect. Maybe you're supposed to feel sad about what's going on, but it's a thrill to listen to this song, as kind of crazy as it may be.
It's a lot like almost the Wilbury songs, where there's kind of one idea and then he just bangs around on it. You know, Neighborhood Bully seems like a similar song to this, that it's not the biggest thing in the world, but he had an idea and then he just, you know, Michael Gray calls them list songs sometimes, where, you know, he just says this and this and this and this. This is just a story song. And also the kids in the foreground and Vietnam and everything else is in the background. It's just a vignette of this person where there's soft focus in the background of some bigger things going on, but that's not what he's biting into here.
Yeah, a great opening line, you know, adjust to what? There's just something so in your face about it that I love. And it's one of those great unheralded Dylan tracks. There are so many of them, to me anyway, that people know all the hits. You know, I always get furious. You know, I'm a satellite radio subscriber, and I want a station that will play Clean Cut Kid. You get all these stations, I can't find one that'll play Clean Cut Kid. And so when they give me that, I'll be very happy, because it's just a ball to listen to.
Well, I mentioned to you we're doing a companion show, Ray Padgett is, of covers, and there's a great unexpected cover of this. People should go check out on that show.
Oh, nice, nice.
So midpoint of the album, or at least the end of the first side or half, Never Gonna Be the Same Again, which is our first 3-star from your list.
Yeah, you know, and three stars, I think, and again, it's been a while since I did these, but I think the idea was that listenable, not objectionable, not that the two-star songs are objectionable, I would say, but you know, kind of a song that you hear it on the record and you're like, okay, that's pretty cool. You know, I'm not going to skip over it. You know, like back in the days with the CD, you know, you'd program away and then skip song five. No, that wasn't the case. Again, a focused idea. You know, he's had this relationship. It's changed him. And that's basically, you know, unlike Clean Cut Kid, where it veers off into all these kind of wacky directions. This one is kind of self-contained. And so it's not that ambitious. But again, sounds pretty good. Some nice little touches there. The backing vocals on this record in general were really good. And I should have mentioned, you know, and I'll remember you, Madeline Kopeck, who does a fantastic job on that kind of duet. That's really nice. But again, on this record, it's on this song, it's pretty good. So not too much there, maybe, but what's there is executed pretty well, I think.
Yeah. And for all of us, I think it's Dylan's voice that sells it, right? I always think of the line at the end of Ratzo's book about, did I work hard? Was I always there doing it? And these aren't songs that his singing lacks passion or intent. It's definitely a minor tune. I just love hearing him sing it.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one thing about this album in general, is that he never feels less than energized, less than like 110% into it, which you can't always say, especially in the 80s. But, you know, every one of these songs, he feels like, and again, that's down to the singing, he feels like he's just diving into this with everything he has. And so I appreciate that as well.
So number six, we have a two-star song, and I would agree. But again, the lower side of this album, and one that I think gets a bit of mockery to some degree, people who are looking for things, is Trust Yourself.
Yeah, just not a lot to it. And it does feel like a little bit of rabbit ears on the case of Dylan, you know, where he's, you know, almost like a Billy Joel song. Billy's been one, and he does it very well, but he'll write songs based on what he hears in the press and and it does feel like he's reacting to, well, everybody's saying I'm the voice of a generation, and probably even more so after the Born Again period, because so many criticized him. Well, why is he doing that? You know, why is he leading people in this direction? So probably a lot of that he's trying to get off his chest, and he does, you know, and it's again, it's not a bad sounding record, kind of has that chugging beat to it. But, you know, like I said, I don't think that kind of guise it really fits Dylan too well, where he's kind of reacting to things. And I don't know if exactly that's what he was doing, but it certainly sounds like it.
Next, we have Emotionally Yours, which is a four-star song on Yours. Another one that I think falls in the I'll Remember You schmaltz category for some people. I think we now have a second version of it, which is actually pretty different on the Springtime set. I think this is one where the overall production affects it more. It's not just some strange instrument or synthesizer or drum machine. It's kind of orchestrated in a way to drip a little bit. But four stars from you. What do you think of that one?
Yeah, again, I like the melody. You know, I think that's the Dylan's always get underrated in that respect. You know, it's very nice. It's a song where, you know, and I've seen people criticize it where they say, oh, he uses the word baby like 11 times. Well, I don't have a problem with that. Every soul song that's, you know, great soul song that's ever been written kind of does similar things. So the fact that the OJs kind of turned it into a hit tells you that it was in that vein. Again, it's just very simple, very straightforward, to the point, and he makes that point pretty well. And again, a nice bridge. I think there are a lot of nice bridges on their middle eight, whatever you want to call it. This is a very, very 80s production. This one is certainly kind of movie ballad kind of production by Baker, or mixing by Baker, whatever you want to call it. But again, that doesn't disqualify it for me. And I just think what it's trying to achieve, again, it does it really well. And, you know, I love listening to it. I love the slow stuff. This one probably have it rated higher than most, but I'll stand by that.
I think looking at it this way, it's an album in many ways that's far worse on paper than it is in real life. Because you can, like, you know, it's hard to sort of really defend some of these songs, especially when you are thinking of the canon, but it doesn't come off that way when I play it. I think it's a lull. It's a step down. It just, you know, not disappointing in any way. And I think there's enough Dylan-esque in there. Yeah. You know, we have the simplicity of the lyrics you know, maybe you don't have to hear them as many times, so to speak. I mean, I guess it's, I wonder how much it's the production that people, you know, fault, and how much is the, there was no indications of the Nobel Prize, you know, in most of these.
You mentioned, you know, kind of this comparing it to the other stuff. I remember when I looked at it again, I looked at that review that you're referencing, and I looked at the comments, and a lot of people were mad at me because that they thought that I rated it higher than Infidels. And I do, you know, like I do, this is an album that I do feel like Infidels was technically maybe better, but not as much fun. And so it's interesting to draw those comparisons between records. And like you said, on paper, what's he doing? You know, he's got all these players. He's been remixed by Arthur Baker. It doesn't sound that great, but you know, it's how it hits you. You know,
I think the cover feels like it drips inside. It sets the tone for people. But we finished strong here, I think, with three really good songs. Yeah. So When the Night Comes Flying from the Sky is next. That is one that there's a, you know, the early version with the Little Steven and the Springsteen guys that people love. Oh, it's 2 stars from you. I didn't realize this. This is a song I really, really like. So go ahead, talk about it.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's all subjective. This one, I feel like, you know, is one of those ones that got away from, but he just couldn't quite find, you know, he talked about that a lot with Caribbean Wind, you know, how he just battled and battled with that song. And then the version that he released on Biograph, I think it was, you know, I love that song and some of the outtakes as well. But I see a lot of people say, oh, you know, I like the Van Zandt bitten, you know, E Street Band version better. And I don't think that the major key kind of suits this song. I think the minor key was the right move. But I think this production is a little too much of the kind of Miami, and I love Miami Vice, but it's definitely in that kind of Miami Vice, you know, chase scene kind of feel to it. And I just don't think it ever suits the lyrics which I think are super ambitious. And, you know, I feel like this is the song that he wanted to be, the one that everybody gravitated to. And I just think, like I said, I mentioned, you know, what is he trying to do? Did he accomplish it? For me, it just kind of veers off. It, to me, it's exhausting a little bit by the end. It just, it's a lot and maybe too much. And so, yeah, I mean, 2 stars, the rating of the last song in the album might seem harsh because, again, the other songs weren't as ambitious, but I just feel like this one just veered a little bit too far off course for me.
The passion, I think, in the vocal is particularly there on the song. I think he's telling a story and really means it. I love all the versions. There's a surprising version on Springtime, which really sounds more, you know, sort of almost acoustic. Maybe it's earlier. I didn't have the book here with all the.
Yeah, that one is probably my favorite of the three. But like I said, I just don't think there was ever a time he kind of wrangled this one into the shape that would kind of get its full potential for me anyway.
Yeah, it's also one of many Dylan songs that maybe I haven't tried hard enough, but I'm not sure I have any idea what's going on in there.
No, not at all what's going on there. Very. Like it's part romance and part of cop apocalypse. It always sounded to me.
Something Burning Baby. 3 stars from you. There's probably some fun or not fun other orderings of this where you put all these, you know, Emotionally Yours and Seeing the Real You at Last and I'll Remember You songs together in the make one side of the album. That's just, I guess you're gone now.
Yeah.
Anyway, Something's Burning. Talk about that one.
Yeah, you know, interesting kind of production arrangement, that kind of Marshall beat. And it's an odd little song. The verses are kind of the choruses. And so it's just different enough for me, you know. And again, I'm not sure, kind of like, well, you know, he's come back to her and she doesn't kind of feel the same way. And you're not quite sure why that is. There's a mention of another guy in there. And it's an odd kind of Dylan song in that respect, because like, I don't know that there are too many others where, you know, I think if you go back to maybe She's Your Lover Now or something like that, you could find some, you go way back, you could find some analogies there where it's like this love triangle kind of thing. But again, intriguing all the way through and not quite sure if I ever have a grasp on it, but that's okay. That's one of its kind of recommending characteristics for me.
I don't have the right musical vocabulary, but the sound and the tone and the tenor of it is different. You know, the beat's different. Dylan's voice is a little huskier. And there's great Dylan lines in here. You know, the Mexico City Blues since the last hairpin curve.
Yeah.
You know, if you just threw that line out, you know, there's about 30 places in Dylan's catalog where that line might have come from.
It might have fit perfect, right?
So then we have a song that by Dylan's story was a fit piece, meaning he needed something. It's, I think, one of the few he recorded entirely once Arthur Baker was there. He went home and I think he said he wrote three songs, and this is the one that he went with to emotionally or sound wise kind of anchor the album. And I do think this is a great one to talk about in the context of the 80s, because I don't think anybody doesn't like this song. It's kind of a giant song in almost all categories, you know, meaning the writing, the singing, the performance, the how it's lasted on stage, and the great covers, duets, and so forth. So it kind of, if nothing else on this album, and I'd argue there's a couple other things that would, it kind of refutes the idea of this, the worthless 80s or the Bob Dylan period you should skip. Talk about Dark Eyes.
Yeah, and you know, you do see it mentioned in that respect a lot. You see these articles, you know, the best Dylan songs from the worst Dylan albums, and you know, Dark Eyes always gets mentioned. And again, I would refute that wholeheartedly as well. But it is just such a massive song. I think he used that word, and he, you know, he tells that story in Chronicles about how he was asked to write it, and he sees that girl, and that kind of brings it all forth in him. But I always kind of heard this song as him looking out at his place in the world and just not feeling really comfortable with any of it, feeling this sense of otherness, not relating to these businessmen shaking hands and laughing. And maybe he's thinking about some of these corporate gigs he plays and you know, like seeing these people and that just not getting anything out of this that means anything to him. And, you know, is he talking about his art, maybe that this is, you know, these crazy lines, you know, like where life and death are memorized? Is that kind of what he means by that? It's inscrutable in a way, and yet you kind of feel it in your gut, and it's relatable in a way, because I think we all have that feeling sometimes that nobody gets us. And I think on its most basic level, that's what Dark Eyes is about. It's just filtered through Dylan's kind of idiosyncratic perspective on everything. And so it hits home if you're looking at it as Dylan singing about himself, or if you kind of relate it to your own life, like you said, sung beautifully, you know, the harmonica comes out, you know, to really kind of cinch the whole deal. And it's just one of my favorite Dylan songs. And it's one of these songs you could talk about it for hours and still not exhaust everything that's going on.
It also strikes me as one of these songs that it could be like, I'm not there, meaning if he mumbled twice as much, it'd be probably just as effective, because the tone and the emotion, you know, he gets it out. Now, these are actually great lyrics, so I'm not, that doesn't happen at all, but I'm just saying there's a feel to this song that it'd be a fun challenge to find another song out of all the songs in the world, not just Bob's songs, that you know, overlaps with the tone and feel of this song, because it's really powerful and unique.
Yeah, and almost like a feeble way that he sings it, you know, almost as if he doesn't want to, you know, bother anybody with this song. And I think it goes to that feeling that he is kind of out there on an island. You know, a lot of people look at that last line, you know, a million faces at my feet and all I see are dark eyes. And is it him saying that gets all this adoration and adulation from fans and people worldwide and his peers, and just isn't fulfilling? You know, it doesn't mean all that much in the long run as compared to maybe very close personal relationships, which maybe been tough for him. I don't know. It's all speculation. And that's the great thing about a song like this, is you can go on and on finding these little meanings in there and trying to get into his head. You'll never get there. But part of the fun is trying. And a song like Dark Eyes really, really gives you the license to do that.
And then 12 years later, he's not looking for nothing in anyone's eyes.
Yeah. That'd be a good little exercise to go through and try to find the contradictions over the years where he does kind of go back and contradict himself, or maybe kind of embellish what he said before.
So, interesting tour through it. And as I said, I do think it doesn't hold up on paper quite as well as I think it does in experience. We have, oh, so you've got 2 fives, 3 fours, 2 threes, and 3/2. So it's a very evenly distributed album, you know, on this scale. And I think you've justified it or held it up well today. But that is not, I think you may have done Knocked Out Loaded on this. I'll have to go bring it back up again. But that is not an album that is going to be so evenly distributed.
No, it's not. As I it's been a while, but yeah, just off the top of my head, no, I don't believe it will be.
But let's look at a few of what not the contemporaneous, but the retrospective, other retrospective reviewers said. So there's a website called Album of the Year that has this particularly negative, you know, the album marks the point when Dylan stopped trying. A pointless album that you're better off skipping. If you're willing to hear Dylan at his weakest, then Empire Burlesque is the best album for that. The cult following has been, you know, churning out a lot of retrospective reviews lately. It says Dylan cannot quite commit himself to being a shoddy version of Sting, so he bows out and tries to adapt his lyrics to a new sound and fails admirably. I think what happened to some degree, look, I think there's two things. There's the weight of the 20 years before and the 20 years after that no one could stand up to. There's the fact that he's a mid-30s, young, early 40s guy. I think he's in his young 40s here, you know, who is the then teaching rock stars how to be in their 40s in a world that's changed, meaning the princes of the world and everyone else is setting the trends and he's got to adjust. All that external stuff, you know, and we had hard, as the cover shows, extreme fashion that didn't age well. It kind of all adds up to the feeling that the 80s weren't cool, which I think we're kind of coming out. I mean, there's a resurgence in the Dylan community of respect for this period, and some because of the bootleg series, and some because as you look at it over a longer stretch, it becomes clear the lows weren't really that low. But you know, it's fun to look at this album in both ways. But I'm glad most people I talk to still like to put it on, which is not true of all the albums in this period.
Yeah, I mean, like that first review, it's just hard to relate to that. It's subjective. It feels like that person didn't listen to it at all to say he wasn't trying, you know, because he was clearly, maybe he, if there's a fault with it, he was trying too hard to try to kind of find it. But there's also, you know, I think the perspective of it is skewed a little bit by Dylan himself, because, you know, he talks about in Chronicles about how the late 80s, he was just, he didn't relate to anything he was singing and things like that until he kind of found his way again. So it is tough to look at it without all of that outside stuff kind of working its way into your perspective. But, you know, like I said, I just over and over again, I find, you know, I go to the albums and I'm like, yeah, which one do I want to play today? And, you know, I find myself going back to Empire Burlesque a lot. Like I said, it feels like a fun album to me. It's never dull. And so
there is that point that it doesn't to some degree demand that much of you. You can listen to it. There's Dylan albums that you got to be in the mood for.
Yeah.
And this one's easier.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It is something you could put on and not kind of lose yourself in it a little bit. If you're doing something else, you know, you have it as background music. But I do think it also rewards you if you do take the time to get into it. Like a song like Clean Cut Kid, you know, where if you're just kind of listening in the background, you say, oh, that's a cool sounding song. And then you get into the lyrics and you're like, what is he doing here? Where is this all coming from? So I think it does work on both of those levels. And maybe more than any other Dylan record, I find myself defending this one to people. You know, like I feel like, man, you should listen to Empire Burlesque. Street Legal is probably another one that's up there as well. I love Street Legal. And, you know, that one, the critical reception has always been a little bit mixed. But this one, maybe more than most, where I'm just like, man, give Empire Burlesque another shot.
Yeah. And I will say, as I did before, since, you know, I haven't gone back to the CD lately, but if you can stream it in high res, and I assume it's a high res on Apple Music as well. So that's Apple Music or Tidal, because Spotify doesn't have that, and put a DAC and some reasonable headphones at it. The production, as we talked about before, it's very clean and well done. And it really makes it easier to appreciate to some degree than the muddy version of that kind of production. So, you know, people want to play along with us and just go dig into it. I would take advantage of the essentially free high res we now have.
Yeah, another comparison to Street Legal there, because that album was always docked as well, because the original mixes were apparently kind of muddy. And then, you know, now when you hear it now in high def, you know, or whatever standard you have, it sounds great. So yeah, so another comparison there.
Yeah, that 99 mix remix of Street Legal did help that stuff quite a bit. So one last, I guess it's contemporaneous review that also I think shows the difference in the kinds of reviews. All Music's Stephen Thomas Erlewine at the time, I assume, given actually there's, I think he says something about up till now or something in the review that does date it. Those things aren't dated. It's a better set of songs, all deriving from the same place and filled with subtle gems. So he's actually referring to Infidels there. The most obvious being Tight Connection to My Heart, but also Emotional Years and Dark Eyes, proving that his powers are still there. Now, you know, but this is, I think, one of our better reviewers and certainly one who's done more reviews than anybody I can think of. He also calls it overall well-crafted songwriting that never fails to be interesting. Mm-hmm. So there's a Time review I'm still trying to find and a couple others. I really do think the contemporaneous reviews are in some ways the most interesting.
Robert Christgau, didn't he give it he gave it kind of, you know, and he was notably tough on a lot of Dylan stuff. And I think he said something like, it's his best since Blood on the Tracks. He just wishes that weren't such faint praise as what his line was, which is a great Christgau line. But again, he was kind of on its side, albeit kind of measured on its side, but he was one that kind of came out for it as well.
Yeah. So overall, how do you think about this period in general? I mean, obviously you like some of the music, but in terms of the Dylan story, is there a way that you think about it or rationalize or categorize it yourself, this period where, you know, we know what's to come after this album? He did Infidels, he did this, and then, you know, we got a couple much needier albums. We've heard you like the album. I'm just wondering is there any haze on the 80s for you, or do you just think, I don't know, what do you think of it?
I mean, inconsistent for sure, but for me, not the kind of dead period that a lot of people think it is. I find Shot of Love to be a great record. Like I said, Infidels doesn't hit me quite as hard. You know, the two albums after Empire Burlesque were kind of shaky, with obviously the exception being Brownsville Girl. And then, you know, then Oh Mercy, which I think is really, you know, right up there. I think that's probably a top 10 Dylan album for me. But it was just that it was all over the map. You know what I mean? Like, where we couldn't quite get a read, you know, and again, at the time, I wasn't following him as much. So, you know, I'm only looking at this after the fact, but it seems like if you were following him, you were probably like, oh, okay, he's kind of righted the ship here. And then it kind of went down again. And so that was probably frustrating for fans. But I think taken as a whole, I mean, if you made a mixtape of just Dylan in the 80s, you can come out with a really killer thing at the end of it. And they can really stand up to a lot of the other decades, I think, in terms of the best songs. If you can get by the production touches, which I can, and I know a lot of people can't. But yeah, I think, you know, very kind of erratic, volatile, but still giving you moments that very few other artists could even approach.
Yeah, I haven't done it yet, but I will try to make some playlists. There are alt versions of Empire Burlesque. There's a lot of bootlegs of original tapes that are out there, but given what we now have from the bootleg series and Springtime, the first bootleg series has a couple, and then Springtime, there really is some opportunity to replay with this album and make other versions of it. I'm sure there's a live, someone has made the live version as well, which I'll pull together and share with everybody, just so we can, it's an album that's worth going at a bunch of different angles. And then I think that raises your appreciation, in which case this may not be the definitive set of these songs, but probably if you find the definitive version of each, whether it's some studio or live or a cover, there's probably a pretty excellent complete album that we could make of this. So fun to reevaluate. Thanks for sharing your past and current thoughts, Jim.
Well, there's so much fun to talk. I'll talk about this album anytime you want. Like I said, I'm always defending it, so I love that opportunity.
We'll put in the show notes the links to your work, the links to your book of 100 ranked Dylan songs. So you're a prolific ranker, which is a tough job. And thanks for talking this through with us today.
Yeah, no problem, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening.